Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. David S. Cho. Dr. Cho is a graduate of the Medical School of Virginia and completed his residency at NYU. He is currently the medical director of radiation medicine at Cuga Medical Center in Ithaca, New York, and a staff physician in the Department of Radiation Medicine at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you, Tish. It's good to be here.
Now, let's begin by talking a bit about what attracted you to medicine in the first place.
Sure. That's an interesting story for me, I think. My father is a physician. He's a radiologist who trained in medicine in Taiwan, and he was a flight surgeon there. And we immigrated to this country in 1974. And at that time, the U.S. laxed their immigration policies for physicians because of a short-term shortage of physicians at that time. Mm-hmm. And so many physicians from other countries immigrated to the U.S., and that immigration policy stopped in 76.
Wow.
So that was only a couple of years when there was a shortage of physicians in the U.S., and immigration stopped after that.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the chance of coming to the United States from Taiwan. I was 4 years old at the time, and he was always pushing me into medicine as long as I can remember growing up. He thought it was a good field, it was a stable field, and that, you know, it wouldn't be subject to the ups and downs of the economy so much.
Mm-hmm.
And he always pushed me into it, and I never really thought much about it until after college. I had the opportunity to go into medical school right after high school because I got into an 8-year program, and I had to turn that down, and that, I think, pissed off my dad a bit. But eventually, after college, I decided I would go into medicine, and I went applied to the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, Virginia, and I started medical school in 1994.
So you finally found a passion for this.
Finally,
it sounded like you were somewhat reluctant.
I was. I went to college for engineering. I liked math and physics and engineering, and so I thought I would follow these passions, and I turned down medicine at my first opportunity. But then I finally came around. I was no good at engineering. I got C's in all my engineering classes.
Ah, that would be a reason to say.
So I was no good at that, so I had to find something else to do. So then I decided to go to medical school, and then I think that it took me a while, but then I came around.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied medicine after that. So.
Mm-hmm. And did you choose radiation medicine because that was what your father did, or did you really find an interest in that?
I did find an interest in that, and it's slightly different from radiology. The two fields were very much connected in the 60s and 70s. These were the same doctors that would have the x-ray machines, that would do the x-ray films, and also give x-rays for treating patients for cancer. Those two fields split apart in the late 70s and early 80s into two separate specialties with a similar history. And my father is a diagnostic radiologist, an mm-hmm. x-ray doctor who reads x-ray films, who reads CT scans, and dictates reports in a dark room all day. And I decided to go into an oncology field, which is a radiation oncology field that uses therapeutic radiation that treats cancer. And so our fields, although they have a similar background, are separated now and are different fields. And my father didn't know too much about it at first. He had called up his friends and asked them what the heck I was getting into. But I did find a passion for it in my third year of medical school.
Mm-hmm.
We started doing clinical rotations at that point. The first 2 years are classroom work. And then years three, you start going into the hospital, the wards, and you start following doctors around, and you start seeing what it's like to be a physician in the hospital. And I started falling into oncology rotations when a lot of my classmates didn't want oncology rotations. I was for a month in the pediatric oncology floor.
Oh, that must be difficult.
It is difficult, but I learned about pediatric oncology. I spent a full month with the gynecology oncology surgeons, and they would get up and see their patients at 4:30 in the morning, and so I used to do that with them. I spent a month with the medical oncologist. And so when other people didn't want to do oncology rotations, I liked it, and I found I had a passion for the ill who were infirmed with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't afraid of death or serious illness. And I have felt like a real calling for these patients. And so I learned more about oncology and found out about something called radiation oncology. And that's how I got into it. So mm-hmm. It's something that I really found for myself, and I'm glad I found yeah. something that I really wanted to do.
Can you tell us briefly a little bit about the history of radiation oncology? I mean, how did they discover that radiation would actually even
sure.
kill cancer?
That was about a century history, dating back to the early 1900s, when doctors and scientists like Madame Curie and German scientists like Professor Rankine found this property of radium. They had radium ore and radium needles and wires, but they never knew it that it emitted radiation energy. And it was by accident that Rankin had a radium wire or rod, and he held his hand up, and the x-rays penetrated his hands and developed photographic film that was in a lead case.
Mm.
And he took out the photographic film, he developed it, and he found out, wow, it had a picture of his hand. Well, how would the light get through the lead case? It wasn't light, it was an x-ray or a mysterious ray that went from the radium rock to develop photographic film. So that was the earliest x-rays. And very quickly after that, scientists and doctors experimented with this radiation metal, and they placed it next to patients with very large breast cancers that were outside the body. And after a few days, these cancers would shrink. And we didn't know why that happened. But these were the very first cancer doctors. And there was a famous cancer doctor in Chicago that had a clinic for breast cancer patients as early as the 1916, 1920s.
Wow, that's amazing. And they must have thought it was magic.
It was
first.
Very magical. We had no idea about DNA, about the atom. We had no information about that. And it took 100 years for us to understand the atom, for us to understand radiation particles, for our physicists to understand particle physics, and for our biologists to understand DNA, and for all those things to come together until we now understand or have a very good theory about how radiation works with biology.
Huh. Wow, it's quite an amazing history. Now, let's talk a little bit about people going through radiation therapy. So somebody's diagnosed with cancer.
Right.
How many treatments? How do you know? How do you know what kinds of tumors might react to this kinds of
therapy? Well, we know from studying the treatment of cancer. We have the earliest studies of probably cancer medicine way back in the 1920s. But those weren't really good studies. Only kind of modern studies, early randomized trials starting in the 70s with women with breast cancers really showed us the way of how to best treat cancer. And all of our knowledge today are based on randomized trials that were started in really the early 70s.
Mm.
And they're famous trials back then. And cancer medicine, I think, is a good field for this, where we try to base a lot of our treatments based on data. We don't treat because, oh, we think this should work, or I have a gut feeling that this works.
Mm-hmm.
But we try to base what we do based on trials, studies that doctors wrote up and spread and gave to other doctors, and they cooperated, and they asked patients, would they be willing to enter these trials? And they took in hundreds and thousands of patients, and group one this and group two that, and they compared them and watched these patients for years. And lo and behold, A is just as good as B, or A is better than B. And these are data that you can't fudge, and that is proven with the best and most rigorous means of science.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a very good model for other fields and other aspects of medicine. But we know these treatment recommendations because they've been tested before.
And so a patient has to come in week after week.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on their type of cancer,
the tumor, and their overall situation. And we have different regimens that have been studied before and been written up and published. And so we read and we stand on the achievement of other physicians and other doctors.
Well, tell me how, if somebody's coming in and it's on an outpatient basis,
sure,
how do you know that you're going to hit the same spot?
That's a good question. We can't see the spot through the body. We don't have x-ray eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have CT scans and machines that can see inside the body. So before we start a treatment, we plan the treatment with what's called a simulation. And the simulation uses x-rays or CTs to look inside the body, and we create a reference point between the outside of the body and the inside of the body. And these are called setup marks or reproducible marks. And they're literally about two or three tattoos that we put on the front and the side of the patients. And we see these tattoos on the CT, and we see these tattoos on the patient. And we draw on the CT where the cancer is, and we know the reference for the cancer to those marks. And so we can set up the radiation field and set it up on the patient just on those marks and know that the cancer is in that spot inside the body with that reference CT.
Wow.
So we use those.
So they go home and this stuff doesn't wash off.
Right.
Until
well, actually,
much
we,
later.
We give a permanent tattoo. We do a very small point tattoo with a drop of ink and a small needle.
Oh.
And it's just a little spot point, and that's the point where we triangulate the patient's setup. And with that, we know exactly where the cancer is inside. And that allows us to treat the same place every day.
Wow, that's amazing. I was wondering how you did that.
Well, that's
it doesn't need to be precise.
It doesn't need to be precise, and we take x-ray films with our treatment machine every week, and we make corrections if we need to. And we sometimes the cancers move. Prostate is a notorious cancer that can move around. And the prostate, because the prostate organ itself can move around, it's sort of like an organ stuck in jello, and it can kind of wiggle a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so we actually chase the prostate, and we don't just rely on the points on the body, but we do an ultrasound, and so we even chase it even more precisely.
Mm, wow, I've often wondered about that. Now, as somebody who does radiation therapy, mm-hmm. did you also get involved in diagnosis and prevention?
Well, I hear a lot about this, and I read the literature about prevention, and I speak to groups about cancer, and I understand cancer prevention very well. You know, it's not my specialty, but mm-hmm. I do advocate for, you know, stopping smoking, and I understand the data for cancer screening and things like that. So in my training, we did study mm-hmm. this.
Mm-hmm. Well, how important do you think diet is for people trying to prevent cancers?
I think it's very important. I think a diet is an important thing, that if we change the whole country's diet from less red meat to more fruits and vegetables, we would see an incredible incidence of drop of cancer. Mm. Obesity has been linked as a causal factor for cancer. But it's one of the pieces of the puzzle. It's not the whole puzzle. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't wipe out cancers completely if everyone in the United States ate very little red meat and more fruits and vegetables. We would reduce it substantially. Another thing we could do is if everyone stopped smoking, that would also decrease some of the pressure for cancer incidence. But it wouldn't eliminate it right away. And you would see trends slowly declining, because your risk for cancer declines after you stop smoking, but it doesn't drop to zero right away. Mm-hmm. So if you're in a greater population, if everyone stopped smoking right tomorrow, we would still see smoking-related cancers, but they would slowly decline. Mm-hmm. So there are many factors. And even with all those things, we wouldn't stop out cancer completely. There are still cancers that occur that we don't know why. There are rare lung cancers that occur without smoking. There are breast cancers that occur in people who are fit. There are brain cancers who occur in people who are very fit. So we wouldn't stamp out cancer completely, but we would decrease a lot of the environmentally associated cancers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now I'm assuming that you saw that New York Times article and study on radiation therapy and some of the problems.
I only saw it. I framed it in my office.
Did you?
Uh-huh.
Well, has that changed anything in regard to the way things are going to be done locally, say?
Well, not for my department, no. I read over the article, and I shared the article with my department, and we actually had a meeting about the article. And we understood the reasons why those two horrible cases occurred. These were two...
And just for my listeners, yes. Go ahead and tell them a little bit about it.
Sure, this was a New York Times article published about two Sundays ago, and it had a small lead in the front of the paper and a very big spread in Section A. And it told about two horrible radiation accidents in New York City in 2005. Mm-hmm. One was in St. Vincent's Hospital, where a patient with head and neck cancer received much too much radiation because of a glitch in a computer problem. And another one was in a hospital called Brookdale Hospital in Brooklyn, where a woman received three times the amount of dose of radiation to her breast because of a piece of equipment wasn't put into the machine
mm-hmm. And
properly.
the technician wasn't paying attention.
The technician didn't pay attention. The physicist who planned the radiation didn't pay attention. The physician didn't pay attention. Mm-hmm. So she received three times the amount of radiation to her chest and had a horrible radiation damage and injury to her skin, which did not heal up and resulted in her eventual passing. So those were two horrible accidents that occurred in New York City in 2005. The New York Times studied a period of 8 years. New York State, the amount of mistreatments and accidents, and there were 133 in New York State in that 8-year period of time. Mm-hmm. And these were the two worst. And these were horrible accidents. And the St. Vincent's accident was actually made into a teaching point, into a PowerPoint presentation for the International Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Mm-hmm. And they actually made a talk, and this was one of the cases that they reported, that the radiation injury in 2005. And they tried to teach people what happened, what were the reasoning, why the machines glitched, and why this error occurred. And so my physicist knew about this talk. We looked over it in our department, and we understand why the reason that happened, and we continue every precaution that we already are taking to make sure these things don't happen.
Yeah, I understand that. I want to bring something else up again, but mm-hmm. if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. David S. Cho. He's currently the medical director of radiation medicine at Cuba Medical Center and a staff physician in the Department of Radiation Medicine at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in mm-hmm. Buffalo.
That's Roswell Park in Buffalo, a very large cancer, NCCN cancer organization, uh-huh. and they employ me to be here and work in Ithaca.
Oh, that's interesting. But in regard to that article, do you think that that's a problem across the board of having technicians who are poorly trained in radiation? That was one of the things that the article brought up.
That is one of the things, and there are guidelines but no laws in place to require how many technicians are treating a patient and how much training that they have. There are some, the technicians, they have their own organization and own guidelines, but they recommend that there's two well-trained technicians be treating patients at every center. But that's not a law in New York State or nationally. And so there are facilities that I'm aware of around these environs that have only one technician treating patients at a time. And when you have one technician there, there's not someone else that can overlook and double-check things.
Yeah.
And errors occur more often.
Mm-hmm.
So we in our department always have two, oftentimes we have three therapists treating on our machine, overlooking each other's shoulder. I'm there full-time overlooking them. And we have physics checks in our department. We have Roswell Park sending their chairman of physics, Dr. Matt Pogorsak. He was here today, and he comes in and reviews our treatments every month to make sure we're on par and we don't make mistakes.
Well, that's great. Yeah, because people can be distracted, and then
of course,
the patients you have to worry about.
Sure. And
these, understand that.
And this is a problem not only in radiation, but in all parts of medicine. You know, there are errors that occur in all parts of medicine. We hear stories of wrong medications that are given, or the surgery is given to the wrong person or the wrong part of the body. And that happens day in and day out. So I don't think these radiation errors are any different than any other medical errors.
Yeah.
Medical errors can be deadly. You know, they can cost patients their lives. They can maim patients. And we are committed to reducing errors in our department and as well as every other department in Cougar Medical Center.
Yeah, I would assume so. Now, let's talk about some of your specialties. I know one of your specialties is prostate cancer.
Sure.
Have we made any headway in preventing and curing and prolonging life?
We have. If you look at the numbers throughout the United States, the number of men dying from prostate cancer are declining year to year. Every year, fewer men are dying from prostate cancer, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very slow but gradual improvement in the treatment of prostate cancer, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're learning more about it every year. In the last few years, there have been some great, very eye-opening studies that have come out with regards to prostate cancer, PSA screening, and a lot of controversy has come out over the last 2 years about whether PSA really works, whether, you know, early detection is the, you know, the key or not.
Can you explain to people what PSA means?
PSA is a blood test for a antigen called prostate-specific antigen. And it's actually an antigen or molecule that your prostate gland secretes, that all men, after the age of puberty, your prostate gland secretes this antigen. And it was actually discovered at Roswell Park in the mid-80s, and is used to look for early prostate cancer. And there's been a lot of controversy about whether looking for it really makes a difference or not. And so countries like Canada don't use the PSA to look for prostate cancer early. We here in the United States do use it quite a bit. And two major studies came out last year looking at whether it really saves prostate cancer lives. And that's a whole nother show. But there's a controversy about that. But yes, you know, studies like that have come out, and we're learning more about it, about what best to do, and there are national guidelines for doctors like myself to recommend, you know, treatments or watching prostate cancer that are available to all doctors. And so I think we're trying to more unify treatment algorithms. But, you know, you can't hurting doctors or, you know, telling doctors what to do is kind of like hurting cats. Doctors are going to do what they want to do. So all you can do is try to get the information out to the public, try to encourage patients to talk with their doctors, and let patients know that prostate cancer is a very curable disease, and fewer men are dying from prostate cancer every year.
And then one of the things about prostate cancer I've always heard is that it's a very silent disease.
It is
People do not know they have it. It's slow growing.
It is very slow growing cancer. It is silent. Men really don't have much problems from the prostate cancer itself. The prostate can enlarge and cause men to go to the bathroom more often, but the cancer itself is very silent inside the prostate. So the only way of knowing that it's there is to check the PSA and to do a biopsy. And only after we do a biopsy or a sampling of the prostate gland with a needle do we actually see the cancer cells on a slide and you know, can say that there's really cancer or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about breast cancers in women especially?
Yes, that's...
Are we making headway?
We're making headway as well, yes. Fewer women are dying from breast cancer every year, and recently there have been recent data that came out from American Cancer Society that shows a significant bend in the curve of the number of women dying of breast cancer, yes. So breast cancer is one of the cancers that we've studied so extensively. We've studied breast cancer more than almost any other cancer. Mm-hmm. And it's due to activism of women in the 70s and the strength of doctors setting up studies as early as the 1970s, controlling the studies and having an experimental arm and finding out exactly what's the best way of treating. And so we've made slow and very consistent progress in treating breast cancer. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's good that you bring that up, too. Women's activism has helped because women, you know, I mean, historically, women have been neglected medically. Studies have all been about men from the early days.
Yes, and there's still a little bit of that, but women started really organizing in the 70s and putting studies together. And the earliest groups were the National Surgical Adjuvant Bowel and Breast Projects coming from surgeons in the Pittsburgh area. And they've now have over like 40 or 50 randomized trials that they've finished for women with breast cancer. And they've studied rectal cancer as well, and they're studying lung cancer this way. And so breast cancer has really come a long way. And now we have some very good data so that medical oncologists and radiation doctors can tell patients what's the best thing to do. And sometimes we have a lot of options for women. Sometimes women don't like a lot of options because it can complicate things. But because of all these studies, we now have options to tell women about different ways of treating their cancer. Mm-hmm. And
are we using radiation more? Because, I mean, historically we always hear about women having to have mastectomies and chemotherapy.
Right.
Is radiation being used more for breast cancer?
It's used for women to keep their breast. Before the 70s, many women were getting mastectomies and to remove their breast cancer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Studies from the 70s show that you don't have to do that. You can, for certain cancers less than 4 centimeters, if you can do a small surgery and cut out the cancer, we can give radiation and for a course, and the women can keep their nipple and keep their breast and keep the majority of their shape. So you don't have to have a mastectomy. Very rare situations do you have to have a mastectomy.
Mm, so that has changed.
So that has changed, and that has been a revolution since the 70s, so that mastectomies nowadays is the exception instead of the rule. And the smaller surgery called the lumpectomy is much more common.
Now, do you think we're overusing radiation in general in medicine? Well, what do you think about that?
That's a good question. Radiation comes from many sources. My radiation is therapeutic and very strong, and we use it only when we need to. But the other radiation that's more common is the radiation from X-rays, CT scans.
Diagnostic,
right. That's the stuff that my dad does.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that field is exploding, and there are probably 10 or 20 times the number of doctors, of radiologists, as there are types doctors of myself. So there are much more types of diagnostic radiologists, a lot more CTs, a lot more X-ray machines. And because of that, the population as a whole is getting more radiation. Because if you divide the number of studies by the population, that number keeps increasing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that is a fact. The population itself is getting more and more radiation. And if you study that and you put that number in and you say, well, for that much radiation, you're going to get one patient with radiation-induced cancer, then if the number of radiation is increasing, then of course you're going to have more radiation-inducing cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes sense only for population. It does not make sense for an individual. For one individual, we can't say that if you get, you know, 2, 3, or 4 CT scans, you're going to get cancer. You increase slightly your risk for cancer, but the risk is very small. You have to study this risk in a population of a million for really to really make sense. So for one individual patient, if their doctor recommends a CT scan and it's necessary to look for something serious, then it really makes sense. But when we do millions and millions of more scans over the population, it's very much true that the population is being exposed to more radiation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's that dichotomy of population versus individual that's very hard to tease out.
How do you know when a cancer is going away? Can you actually see it shrinking when you're giving?
Yes, and we use week after week. Well,
we don't.
Sometimes for lung cancers we can see that, but the best way to see it is with a CAT scan that uses radiation.
To
look at the cancer, and so that is the best way of looking at lung cancer, and we use that again before and after our radiation to look at the cancer. So we need kind of radiation of the CAT scan to find out if our radiation work to kill the cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So that is still a very important part of our assessment of cancer is the CAT scans that use radiation, yes.
I want to ask you this. I mean, you obviously work in a field where a lot of people die.
Yes.
Cancer,
mm-hmm.
especially.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of a toll does it take on you as a human being to have to deal with this day in, day out? I know you have triumphs, but what about the death?
The deaths are trying, but I think we have to realize that we're all going to die. And I've chosen this profession because I find honor and real reward in helping patients in their most dire time at the time of death. I think doctors find reward in different types, you know, different parts of the patient's life. Some doctors want to be there at the birth. Some doctors want to treat children. Some doctors want to treat adults. And I enjoy treating the elderly. So I see a lot of death in my patients. But I don't find death to be sad. I find death to be a part of life, and that if I can help patients through this difficult time of death, then I've really done something for the patient. And so, I really think that because I feel this way, I can be in this field, and I can understand that patients do die, but we're all going to die one day.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if we can help patients through this tough time or help their families through this period of their life, then I've done something, I think, that I find is important.
Mm-hmm. And do you actually get training in how to deal with families and patients and tell them about death? And can you tell when somebody doesn't really want to know?
Yes, I can tell when someone really doesn't want to know. And we have a lot of denial, and denial is bigger than a river in Egypt. But we see it, and I do get training, but it's more on the job training, and I do it every day. I tell patients about results of tests, and I try to be upfront with them. I don't like to sugarcoat things, and I give them to the point where they can understand it. I'm always available for questions, and we're there, every day. So I think because we're there and consistent, we end up being a support pillar for patients. And people grieve in different ways, and people deal with loss and deal with bad news in a lot of different ways. And we see that whole spectrum. But it's just the human condition to deal with that. And we never blame people for, with their actions. We just try to help them through that difficult time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we only have about a minute left. I know you've been in this profession for over 25 years at least. Do you see any breakthroughs coming in the
near future?
21st century?
Oh, there are always going to be breakthroughs coming. I think as we study more of the genetic code, if we do more randomized trials, if we study the cancer, the treatments we do, they're going to be slow, progressive, forward-moving progress in the treatment of cancer. And so we're not going to be moving backwards.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, they're going to be slow progress. It's hard to say what's going to be on the horizon, but there are new drugs on the horizon, new ways of treating, new ways of doing surgery, and so there's always going to be progress. I think another major progress we could make is stamping out smoking. If fewer people smoke, more people eat a better diet, it would be stamping out more cancers than all the drug research that we have. But it's a tough message to get out there.
Uh-huh, changing people's behaviors.
Changing people's behaviors. We have millions of dollars, billions of dollars of advertisements that kind of push people into eating foods that's bad for us.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes, an individual to change their diet and exercise and to eat well and to rest and to feel better that way. And so that really makes a big difference.
So here on the 21st century, we're in a very low-tech
that's right.
moment. All you have to do is change your diet, quit smoking.
That's
That'll
right.
take us way into the future.
Way into the future. Eat your vegetables. Cut down on the meat and white flour. That's all there is to it. Eat more fruits and vegetables.
That's
and that
great.
That goes a long way.
That's great. Well, Dr. David S. Cho, thank you so much for joining us. And keep up your wonderful work.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.